Lord, I ask that your spirit would be so present in this environment, that this atmosphere would just be filled with your love, your grace, your truth, your empowerment. And God, I ask that as multiple generations come together and fill the space, Lord, that we would be united truly in your blood and in your name, Jesus. God, I love you. These people love you. You are just simply awesome, Jesus. In your name we pray. Amen. Have a seat, guys. Well, hey, before we get started with everything, there's a couple things that I wanted to share briefly with you. Family Fun Day at the Stish Farm is happening today from 3 to 6 p.m. Stishes, could you raise your hands real quick? Stishes, are you guys in here? Nope, not in here. All right, if you know who the Stishes are, go ahead and talk to them. If you are new with us, come approach me or Pastor Ryan or the person you came to church with, and we will introduce you to the Stishes so that you can get connected to the Stish Farm. As well as reverse trick-or-treating, it's a great family opportunity for us to come together and give out candy to people. Instead of receiving candy, we give out candy. And so this is taking place Halloween at 5 p.m. at the Little Falls Care Center. And the last thing that I wanted to share with you, we had a trunk-or-treat event that we partnered with some other churches and organizations and persons in the community a few days ago. And Joetta and her team, they passed out 120 invites. Isn't that amazing, church? 120 families have the opportunity and the bridge to come to Alliance Church because people sent those simple invites out, which is just fantastic. So that's exciting to see. But if you are new with us today, welcome. It's great having you here. Today is Youth Sunday, and it is tradition and an opportunity for students to have a platform to use influence, to use their talents and gifts to share the gospel, whether through singing, through prayer, through giving financially, or through teaching. So thank you for coming today, and I appreciate that. So last week, we kicked off our missions emphasis series, Peculiar People, right? And Ryan, he hit it hard on the head what a peculiar person is. And peculiar people, they are set apart and countercultural. That's a peculiar person. And it's true. It's totally true, church. We see that in Exodus when God lays down the foundation as why he is establishing a covenant with the Israelites. Check this out. This is Exodus 19:6. And you will be my kingdom of priests, my holy nation. That is not a bad deal at all. I mean, of course the Israelites were excited to sign up with this covenant with God because they're going to be a kingdom of priests. They're going to be set apart. They are going to be known. They're going to have purpose. And that's something that we all strive for and are hungry for. But to reemphasize this, Peter, one of the disciples of Jesus Christ in the New Testament, he reiterates this again in the New Testament to the local church. And this is in 1 Peter. But you are not like that. For you are a chosen people. He's talking to the local church. You are royal priests, a holy nation, God's very own possession. God's very own possession, right? There is an overemphasis, an overarching theme that when we are in God, when we are in Jesus, you're going to be peculiar. You're going to be set apart. And so scripturally, we see an emphasis on peculiar people. And even culturally, there's an emphasis on peculiar people. In 1995, some of you, you know, remember 1995 very well. I don't. In 1995, a D.C.-based band known as D.C. Talk released an album called Jesus Freak. And the song that everybody knows, Jesus Freak, emphasizes this. A Jesus freak is someone who is so passionate for Jesus that they are ruined for Jesus. A Jesus freak is someone who is so passionate about Jesus that they are ruined for Jesus. And I love that because I just see boldness. I see raw power in this statement because the reality of it is the gospel has fangs. It does. It has fangs, and it's going to be offensive, which is just awesome because it invites people into a genuine, authentic relationship with Jesus Christ. Because when we are passionate about Jesus, when you get excited for Jesus, when you have kingdom vision, guess what, church? You are going to be ruined for Jesus. which is awesome. And it's very evident then that scripturally and even culturally, like I know in this day and age, in the 21st century and even the later portion of the 20th century, that we feel that maybe as a country we're drawing away from God. There is some truth to that statement, but I want to push back and I want to be that anomaly that says, guess what? There are still people of influence out there that are ruined for Jesus in our country, that are ruined for Jesus in our communities and in our schools. And it's true. It is so true. So how peculiar are you? Right? How strange are you? Now, I ask that intentionally because I myself, I have to answer that with you. How peculiar is Chris? How peculiar is Michael or Christian or Kara? I have to admit, it's not always a natural inclination of mine to want to stand out. And I get it. I'm a pastor. You know, I'm up here standing up, set apart right now. But that's not a natural inclination of mine. I don't necessarily want to do that. But if we have this thought process, if we have that mindset of not wanting to be a part, to stand out from the audience, how gospel intuitive is that then? Right? How gospel intuitive is that? Are you willing to be ruined for Jesus even if it means standing out? And so I looked up some peculiar synonyms, and check this out. We have unique, we have strange, we have odd, we have unusual, and personal. Unique, strange, odd, unusual, personal. Then I looked up some peculiar antonyms, and then we have common, we have normal, we have ordinary, we have standard, and we have usual. Of those list of words, which list best describes Jesus? I can tell you right now, Jesus was not common. Jesus was not normal. He certainly wasn't ordinary or standard. He wasn't usual. In fact, he was pretty unusual. Which list describes Jesus? And I asked that question when I was doing my research on peculiar people. And if I'm called to be peculiar, then I'm called to be joined with Jesus Christ, and I'm called to be part of a royal priesthood. And listen, church, there is nothing common, there is nothing normal or ordinary or standard or usual about that. It's strange. It really is. It is so weird to consider myself a part of a royal priesthood. I mean, that's language you don't hear today, but that's biblical truth and biblical language, and that's Jesus-centered language. And so growing in my own discipleship process, as all of us are, I'm continually realizing just how peculiar I need to be. In fact, you can ask a couple of my students how peculiar or strange I am, and they can probably confirm that. I doubt they'll deny it. So here's the first slide. Since we are the church, we are called to be a peculiar group of people. This local body, Little Falls Alliance Church, listen, you guys are weird. You guys are strange. I love it. You guys are peculiar, and we're called to be peculiar. Embrace it. Now think about it. We as an organization, we are aware of the spiritual consequences and implications in people's lives. That's weird. There's nothing normal about that statement at all, that we as a church, as a local body, as a congregation, as an organization, the fact that we are aware of the spiritual consequences, of the spiritual implications in people's lives, those who know Jesus and those who don't know Jesus, that's not normal at all, right? Like most organizations or gatherings, they're going to be focused on a physical outcome, not a bad thing, that's not a bad thing at all. But we, as the local body, as the church, we have a high emphasis on the spiritual matters of a person or group. That's weird. That is so peculiar. And then we have the head of our church, our CEO, who laid down his own life for a bunch of disgruntled employees. It's the reality of things, right? I mean, like the disciples, they bailed on him. And then some of them began denying him. As far as I could remember, only one was present at his crucifixion. Sounds like a bunch of disgruntled employees. But the reason that my CEO, my mighty king, your king, the sovereign Lord, the reason he did that, the reason he laid down his life, was so he could redeem you and me. That's the gospel in its simplicity, church. Then Jesus partners with me, Jesus partners with you, and guess what? He sends us out into the world. That is strange. My king lays down his life for me, a disgruntled, sinning boy, so that he can partner with me and send me out into the world and bring redemption and hope to this world, bring hope and redemption to Little Falls. That is so strange. There's nothing normal about that, church. I love it. But how does that affect your day-to-day life? How does it affect you? And today I want to emphasize the next generation to you, a generation that whether you intentionally or unintentionally interact with affects you. In other words, this next generation is going to affect you. They will. They are a strange group. This is a generation that's completely immersed in technology. They haven't known a day without technology. Some sociologists call them digital natives or iGen, which means the internet generation. This is a generation that is becoming extremely ethnically diverse. In fact, roughly 55% of the next generation is only Caucasian. This is a generation that was born after 9/11. I was in third grade when 9/11 happened. I remember I was walking to music class when I heard about the Twin Towers for the first time. But this is also a generation that is hungry, relentless for purpose. And so millennials, Xers, boomers, traditionalists, we have the unique opportunity to partner with one another, to partner with Jesus, and to disciple the next generation and champion them to the faith. So we can literally be the catalysts and the passing of faith to the next generation. But to do that, we need to equip ourselves. We need to have the necessary tools to be the catalyst and the passing of faith to the next generation. And today, as we pray, as we worship, as we sing, as we go into our small groups, as we give financially, as we come together and follow Christ as the local body known as Little Falls Alliance, we're going to equip ourselves with the crucial tools necessary for the transference of faith. And so the people that I focused on a lot when I was doing this research, I focused a lot on Hannah, who is Samuel's mom. I focused a lot on Eli, who in a sense was Samuel's mentor. And I focused on Samuel himself when he was an adult, because he passed the faith on and empowered a young individual to become the king of Israel. And so all these characters, Hannah, Eli, Samuel, they all had specific tools in the passing of faith to the next generation. And as I was reading through the scriptures, I noticed those specific tools had a connection with character qualities that each of those characters possess. And those characters were significant in transferring the faith. And so I took those qualities and I formulated them to five crucial tools. And so the first one is grit. The second tool is submissiveness. The third tool is unity. And the fourth tool is discernment. And the fifth tool is celebration. Now, I believe that if we embody these tools, that we embody grit, submissiveness, unity, discernment, and celebration, we are going to have a high success rate of seeing people say yes to Jesus and grow in their personal relationship with Jesus Christ and find a specific role with their gifts in the local church. I really do. I really believe we will have a high success rate. Likewise, these tools, they're not only going to impact the next generation, they are going to impact you in your own personal relationship with Jesus as Jesus molds you and forms you to resemble him. And so the first tool is grit. What exactly is grit? If you're familiar with TED Talk, TED Talk talks about this briefly. So grit is perseverance or resilience. Now, how you develop grit, according to some of the studies that have been taking place, you are pursuing something higher than yourself. And what's really funny about this study, they have no idea how you actually develop grit. They only know how to describe grit, the pursuit of something higher than yourself. But guess what, church? I know how to develop grit. And I'm willing to bet you know how to. Because when I look at this pursuing something higher than yourself, and in secular terms, that means pursuing our dreams, passions, or vision, yet they still don't know how to do it. They just know what it is. Maybe you know what I'm stepping in. There's something really spiritual about this. Pursuing something higher than yourself, well, let's replace something with someone. And if we take this concept of pursuing something higher than ourselves, we can then equate that to pursuing Jesus. And as we pursue Jesus, Jesus is going to put us in situations where we need perseverance and resilience. With the Christian Missionary Alliance, you have missions on a global scale everywhere. There are some pretty uncomfortable situations. Even with Christ followers locally or globally, God is going to strategically put you in geographical locations that may be uncomfortable. For example, middle school and high school. Middle school and high school, super uncomfortable. Or your place of employment, there's probably some uncomfortableness to that. That's intentional. Jesus is doing that for a reason, right? Or maybe for some of us, it's financial difficulties, yet we're still being stretched and called to be faithful to financially give to the local church. Or maybe for some of us, it's parenting and navigating through the delegation of consequences with our own children. Because let's be honest, parents, we don't want to mess up our kids. Parenting is such a scary job. Or maybe we're trying to discern how to honor and discern appropriate outcomes that build Jesus' kingdom, right? And so to get into the biblical matter of pursuing someone higher than ourselves, we see Hannah, this is Samuel's mom in the Old Testament, going through a process of developing grit as she is pursuing God. Check this out. This is 1 Samuel 1, 6. Benaiah would taunt Hannah and make fun of her because the Lord had given her, and that's Hannah, had given Hannah no children. Next verse. Once after a sacrificial meal at Shiloh, Hannah got up and went to pray. Hannah was in deep anguish, crying bitterly as she prayed to the Lord. It's obvious here that Hannah couldn't be a mom. I can't imagine walking through that process. I can't imagine not having my own biological children. Recently, I had a good conversation with a very good friend of mine discussing this. It was such a God moment. I won't go into the details, but it brought relevancy into today's message for me when we were talking. But Hannah couldn't be a mom. Hannah's husband's second wife mocked Hannah. Hannah's husband's second wife mocking her. Hannah was probably jealous of the fact that she couldn't have her own children. I believe that the other wife had somewhere around 10 children. And even though we didn't specifically read it right here, in verse 8, Hannah's husband lacks empathy and sympathy for her. If I'm recollecting correctly, verse 8 states that her husband says, "Aren't I good enough for you? I'm better than 10 kids." Dude, you don't say that. That's awful. She wants to be a mom. That is her maternal right and instinct. And so motherhood seemed impossible for Hannah. It wasn't fair, and it was extremely painful for her. Was God still present, though, church? Was he still there? Absolutely. In fact, God was in the presence of developing grit in Hannah. And if we have to develop grit by pursuing God's higher callings, and this is going to be uncomfortable, church. You know, you might feel like a little bit of the back of your hair standing up or a tingle go up your spine. If we're called to pursue God's higher callings, then we have to believe and accept that God is going to place us in uncomfortable circumstances. Paul in Romans 5:4 talks about this. He talks about how the results of being made righteous in God, when you say yes to Jesus and when Jesus puts you in uncomfortable situations, you have the unique opportunity of having unending joy. There's hope. There's a lot of hope for us, church. Even when we're in the process of developing grit, we can still have joy. And it's through this process of yearning for motherhood that God was pruning Hannah and drawing Hannah to the Father's heart. God was in the process of redeeming her. Oh, that's awesome. That is so cool. That despite these difficulties, despite the struggle, maybe the jealousy, the lack of empathy and sympathy from the family, that we have a mighty King, a Father who is intentional and is guiding us and walking with us through the process. He doesn't take the difficulties away. I want to be clear about that. He doesn't take them away, but he is still there yearning for you, drawing you towards his heart, because, man, he's just crazy for you. And likewise, we need to develop grit so that we have the perseverance and resilience. And so Jesus, he's going to put us in uncomfortable situations, especially when we minister to the next generation. Ministering to teenagers today, man, it can be scary. It really can be. Or maybe you're in a marriage relationship right now. Being married, pretty scary sometimes. But God is going to stretch us, and he's going to make us to resemble his son, and it's going to be a beautiful process. And by developing grit, you begin to pursue Jesus' heart, because Jesus' passions become your passions. And when you pursue his heart, you get to understand the heart of Jesus. You get to understand the heart of the Father. And then the things that break Jesus' heart, church, they're going to break yours. All because we are developing grit. Grit is important. The second thing, the second tool that we need is submissiveness. By developing grit, Hannah begins submitting her dreams for kingdom vision. I'm going to say that again. By developing grit, Hannah begins submitting her dreams for kingdom vision. Check this out. This is 1 Samuel 1:11. And she made this vow, "O Lord of heaven's armies, if you will look upon my sorrow and answer my prayer and give me a son, then I will give him back to you, and he will be yours for his entire lifetime, and as a sign that he's been dedicated to the Lord, his hair will never be cut." It's clear what her dream is. She wants to be a mom. Like, she is ecstatic about the fact that she wants to experience motherhood. She wants to nurture her child. She wants to carry her child. She wants this badly, but she's realizing that there's a bigger picture, there's a bigger dream, and a bigger process that's taking place around her spiritually and physically. And so she surrenders her maternal rights. She sets apart her dreams for the accomplishment of kingdom vision. And I gotta say, in the New Testament, you see Mary do this. Let's personify this process. Mary carried Jesus for 9 months. Mary probably felt Jesus do this a couple times and maybe a couple of these, right? Like, it happens. Like, if you're a mom, you know that when you're carrying, you're going to feel your kid kicking you, and then you're going to feel that really awkward moment where the kid kicks your bladder. You know what I'm talking about. Right? Mary went through that process. Mary gave birth to Jesus. If they had diapers back then, guess what? She cleaned Jesus' butt. That happened. Jesus was human. That happened. But here's the point. Here's the bigger picture. Here's what I'm gathering at. Mary also saw her son be crucified. Everything in her screamed to protect her baby boy. But she surrendered her maternal rights so that kingdom vision could be accomplished. Samuel also submits what his ideal king should look like. He submits earthly vision for kingdom vision. So Samuel now, at this point, he's an adult and is on the hunt for another king. This is 1 Samuel 16:7. "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Don't judge by his appearance or height, for I have rejected him. The Lord doesn't see things the way you see them. People judge by outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" All right, so in this context, Samuel is looking for a new king to replace the current king, whose name is Saul. And so Samuel comes to Jesse's house and meets a bunch of Jesse's boys. And he goes through this kind of like bachelorette process of, oh, is this the one? Nope. Is this the one? Nope. But he's judging by outward appearance. And finally, there's no more kids left. And he's like, "Jesse, what's up, man? Are there more sons?" "Oh, yeah, there's one more. He's the youngest. He's out in the field." "Well, bring him here," right? Samuel had to surrender what his ideal king would look like for what God was saying. No, this is who the king should be. Look at his heart. It's amazing. Both Samuel and Hannah had to swap earthly vision for kingdom vision when impacting the next generation. Hannah had to submit her maternal rights. Samuel had to submit what he thought was the ideal king so that the next generation would rise to the ranks, have positions of influence, and lead people to Jesus and lead people to God. They had to submit their dreams, their aspirations for God's vision. Do you see this, church? Do you see that submissiveness that is exemplified in these characters? God is taking his peculiar people and he's drawing them towards his heart so that they can invest into the next generation. The third tool is this: unity. Hannah synced herself with God's leading for the next generation, and through that unification, a young boy was raised up to follow God and led others to God. Check this out. "In due time, she gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel, for she said, 'I asked the Lord for him.'" Samuel means ask the Lord, right? And then Samuel, he syncs himself with God's leading for the next generation, and through that unification, a young boy was raised up as well to follow God, and he led others to God. Check this out, 1 Samuel 16:12. "And the Lord said, 'This is the one. Anoint him.'" Both Samuel and David, they started their ministries at a young age. Both ministries had high impact in the communities around them. Even Jesus emphasizes the importance of having unity with God. Check this out. This is Matthew 16. "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'If any of you wants to be my follower, you must give up or submit your way and take up your cross and follow me.'" That follow me, that's so important. In order to follow Jesus, we have to be hip to hip to Jesus. We have to be united with Jesus. It's so important for us, church, to grasp this. You have got to be united with Jesus. Because if we are not joined with Christ, then how can we expect to follow Christ? Christ may be leading you to invest in the next generation, and who knows? One of those students, when they grow up, they might be in a position of influence and lead a multitude of people to Jesus. And we could trace that genealogy back to you because you united yourself with Jesus. Can you imagine that influence that you had in the next generation and the next generation having the influence to lead others to Jesus? Man, doesn't that excite you, church? Both Hannah and Samuel, they had to take faith-filled risks. And I get it. Listen, when you say yes to Jesus, that is a faith-filled risk. Because now you are setting yourself apart from the world and you're making yourself peculiar and strange and odd and unusual and not normal. It is a faith-filled risk. I get it. And it's especially a faith-filled risk investing into the next generation. But God honors that. God honored and placed Samuel and David in influential positions. This happened because Hannah and Samuel, they were so in sync to God's leading because they were united with God. So important for us to experience unity with Christ. The fourth tool is discernment. This is better read than told. So if you have your Bibles or a Bible app, open up with me to 1 Samuel 3, 1 through 10. I won't have it on the screen, but this is a really cool story about discernment. I really want you, like, feel free to close your eyes too if you want to. Just don't fall asleep. Feel free to close your eyes and put yourself in this situation, okay? Imagine you're in a house at night and the air is warm. Maybe you hear some mosquitoes flying around. I don't know. I'm not trying to ruin your ideal vision. Don't imagine mosquitoes. Don't imagine mosquitoes at all. But imagine it's nighttime and it's warm. You're asleep. And all of a sudden you hear this strange voice. Meanwhile, the boy Samuel served the Lord by assisting Eli. Now in those days, messages from the Lord were very rare and visions were quite uncommon. One night, Eli, who was almost blind by now, had gone to bed. The lamp of God had not yet gone out. And Samuel was sleeping in the tabernacle near the ark of God. Suddenly, the Lord called out, "Samuel!" "Yes," Samuel replied. "What is it?" He got up and ran to Eli. "Here I am. Did you call me?" "I didn't call you," Eli replied. "Go back to bed." So Samuel did. Then the Lord called out again, "Samuel." Again, Samuel got up and went to Eli. "Here I am. Did you call me?" "I didn't call you, my son," Eli said. "Go back to bed." Now imagine having a kid and you just want to go to sleep. Like if you've had babies and you hear them or you hear them calling out to you, you could probably understand the frustration that Eli is going through right now. "Oh, kid, just go back to sleep. Come on." But Samuel did not yet know the Lord because he had never had a message from the Lord before. That's important. I'm going to read that again for you. Samuel did not yet know the Lord because why? He had never had a message from the Lord before. He doesn't know what God sounds like. He doesn't recognize God's voice. And so the Lord called a third time, and once more Samuel got up and went to Eli. "Here I am. Did you call me?" Then Eli realized it was the Lord who was calling the boy. And so Eli said to Samuel, "Go and lie down again, and if someone calls again, say, 'Speak, Lord, your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went back to bed, and the Lord came and called as before, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel replied, "Speak, your servant is listening." Right, so Eli is blind. Visions and messages from God were rare. And good thing third time's a charm, because Eli discerned appropriately that it was God speaking to Samuel, and then Eli takes this next step and discerns the appropriate next step actions, and Eli discerns with Samuel how he should respond to God. Likewise, church, we need to discern what God is or isn't saying to the next generation. That's on us. If a young person comes to you, consider it a great honor. They're extending partnership with you and say yes to that partnership. Tap into that resource. Extend the partnership back to them and train yourself to know the subtle, gentle whisper of God's voice so that you can discern with the next generation where God may be leading them. Eli could have just said, "Go back to bed, kid." And Samuel wouldn't have learned God's voice. But Eli took that initiative. Eli used discernment and discerned appropriately what God was saying to Samuel. It was crucial for Samuel because though that voice, because he thought that voice belonged to Eli, but though it wasn't Eli, Eli discerned appropriately, and because of that, Samuel learned the voice of God. And I gotta say, as a youth pastor, there are a lot of students who do not recognize God's voice. There are a lot. That's a problem, church. And that's a fixable problem. This was crucial for Samuel because though that voice didn't belong to God, Samuel was able to then learn God's voice, and through the years of adolescence and growing up into his 20s and 30s, he learned to recognize God's voice. He learned to have a relationship with God and commune with God and have community with God. Think about this. Samuel was so in tune to God that God's voice in leading Samuel brought the next generation through the ranks to a position of influence. All because Samuel can trace that genealogy back to Eli, discerning appropriately what Samuel should do. And I think we can make a strong argument that for Samuel to learn and discern God's voice, he needed a caring adult to come alongside him. Is that you? Are you willing to be that caring adult? Consider your career or skill sets, or what you're passionate about, or what you enjoy doing. Maybe hunting or fishing, maybe mechanical work. Did you have a caring adult come alongside you and invest into you? I'd be willing to bet most of you, if not 100% of you, would say yes to that. Young people need caring adults who can discern with them. Young people need caring adults who can discern with them. The last tool is this: celebration. This is really important, because this is somewhat countercultural. We don't like to celebrate a lot, church. I'm not saying like us as a church. I'm just saying culturally, the big umbrella effect. We don't always like to celebrate. But Hannah embodies this. She even writes an entire song of celebration, thanking God that you provided me with a child, and thanking God that she has an opportunity to give this child a platform and opportunities to be with the Lord. Check this out. This is 1 Samuel 1:28-2:1. Now I am giving him to the Lord. This is Hannah saying, I'm giving Samuel to the Lord, and he will belong to the Lord his whole life. And they what? They worshiped the Lord there. They celebrated with the Lord there. Then Hannah prayed, my heart rejoices in the Lord. The Lord has made me strong. Now I have an answer for my enemies. I rejoice because you what? You rescued me. This is a celebration prayer. This is a celebration song of the goodness, of the sovereignty, of the love, the relentlessness of God. How amazing is that? It is so important to celebrate. We see the benefits of their partnership. Hannah celebrates the accomplishments, and it's not her accomplishments. You have to understand that. This is not Hannah's accomplishments. This is God's accomplishments, and she recognizes that and celebrates that. And through a redemptive process, we see God rescue Hannah. I'm in need of rescuing. How about you? Hannah experiences them because she submits her dreams. Hannah then experiences the goodness of God. And in this case, that goodness came to the feeling of a baby growing inside of her, that Hannah gets to experience nurturing her baby after the baby was born. And then Hannah experiences the fulfillment of God's promises. And it's so important for us to remember and celebrate what God is doing. We can't forget to celebrate, church. Those moments of celebration make the difficult work worth it. And so like the reason I share numbers, like for example, 120 invites, the reason I share the numbers of attendance of kids attending Joetta's movie nights, the reason I share those first time yes decisions, the reason I share the spiritual decisions that multiple generations are making is because every number is a person, and every person matters to God, and we have to celebrate the fact that God is redeeming and rescuing people in Little Falls, Minnesota. Isn't that amazing? We need that reminder that God is still at work and that we get to partner with our sovereign King, Jesus Christ. We need grit. We need submissiveness. We need unity. We need discernment and celebration. These are crucial tools that we can all embody to transfer faith to the next generation, to transfer faith to multiple generations, to transfer faith to your brother who doesn't know Jesus, to your sister, your parents who don't know Jesus. We need grit. We need submissiveness. We need unity, discernment, and we need to celebrate, church. And so as we start drawing to a conclusion, this is awesome that we're coming and understanding this, but we need to have those hard discussions. And that's the beautiful thing about the church, because Ryan has done a beautiful job in exemplifying this and sharing this. The great thing about this local church is that we can embody grace. And so gracefully I ask, what tool are you lacking in? Do you lack grit? Are you not pursuing the one higher than yourself? Do you lack submissiveness? What rights, dreams, or visions do you need to exchange so that you can have kingdom vision? Or maybe some of us lack unity with Jesus. What's the wedge between you and Jesus, church? What's the wedge between you and him? Is it anger, distrust, resentment, a need for control? Maybe you lack discernment. No. How often do you talk and listen to God's voice? How often are you in your Bibles or taking faith-filled risks? You know, or maybe you lack celebration. What's keeping you from celebrating the goodness and the redemptive power of Jesus Christ? Is it embarrassment or vision? Embarrassment can be an enemy sometimes. Here's why it's important for you to have grit, submissiveness, unity, discernment, and celebration as tools. It gives you kingdom vision. And kingdom vision is essential in your discipleship process. Because without kingdom vision, you lose drive, and the work of the local church becomes less personal. When I was 22, I worked as a bus driver for the Big Lake School District. And I'm just being honest with you, like one of my crutches in life, my Achilles heel is my pride. I can be a pretty prideful person. And I remember driving home from youth group one time, and I felt God just do this in my heart's door. And it was one of those things like, dude, you gotta do this. Like, you don't have a choice. You will do this. And God was leading me to become a bus driver, and I wanted to start my pastoral career. But that wasn't where God was leading me. And so at 22, I graduated college. All my buddies and friends were going to ministry. We're working with nonprofit organizations. We're working with other corporations. And 22-year-old Chris, who was married, and the idea of starting a family was on the verge of coming to fruition, became a bus driver. But yeah, I had to, I had to submit, you know. But it was through that process of being a bus driver that I learned something really cool. My occupation does not identify me. My occupation does not describe me. Being ruined for Jesus describes me. And so I wasn't known as a pastor. I wasn't known as a teacher. I was not known as a parent. I was known as the Jesus freak school bus driver because I was ruined for Jesus. And in fact, kids would even, who weren't on my bus, they would walk next to my bus and be like, hey, you're that dude who loves Jesus, right? Like, yeah, I am. Oh, cool. And then they walked away. That was the extent of our conversation. But I have to believe that there was a redemptive process, even in those simple words that were exchanged, because through that process of becoming a bus driver, I learned grit, I learned submissiveness, I learned unity, I learned discernment, and I learned celebration, and that gave me kingdom vision where no longer I didn't care that I was a bus driver because I understood the bigger picture and the fact that kingdom vision gave me drive, and I could be the bus driver that preached to you when you were in trouble. It was awesome. It was probably some of the greatest year of ministry that I've had. We are called to be a peculiar people group that is to invest in the next generation so that the transference of faith goes from one generation to the next. Now, if this is to come to fruition, we have to have Kingdom Vision Church. One of our core values here at Alliance Church is serve. Serve by using your gifts and resources. Serve by using your gifts and resources. Now, I believe that if we effectively serve the next generation and pass the faith to them, we have to have that grit, we have to have that submissiveness, that unity, that discernment and celebration as resources. We need those resources. And I'm not saying that those are the only resources. You could probably come up with more resources than I can. But this could be a starting point for someone. I want to invite the youth band back up. Come on up, guys. These students are going to play for you the song called Oceans. and they love oceans, like, a lot. I don't know if you've noticed that. You know, every time there's a Youth Sunday, there's a probability that it's going to be oceans. But I was thinking about it when I was writing this, and I think I know why they love oceans. Oceans is calling us to take next steps in our discipleship process as Jesus molds us into him. And I believe students understand firsthand that this process is quite gritty. I believe students, and this isn't to degrade you guys, I believe students, because they lack real-world experience, they're not afraid to take faith-filled risks, and I envy young people because of that. I wish I lacked experience that I could just be all in for Jesus. But these guys, they're not afraid. And so, church, I invite you to partner with students. Invest into them. Learn to discern so that they can discern too. And in time, we're going to have multiple generations that are crazy for Jesus.